Thank you. I think a lot of people would like historians like me to write a little faster. Thank you very much, Andrew, for that kind introduction. Can you all hear me down the back? If not, we'll turn the sound up. Everybody can hear. Great. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, and some of my colleagues from the State Library, welcome to this lecture. I have to say it's an honour to do the AGL Shaw Lecture, and I hope tonight you'll see me do it justice. In a Western democracy, a certificate of birth is evidence that we could not do without. This identity paper enables us to obtain a driver's licence, a passport, and access numerous other advantages, such as healthcare. Likewise, certificates of marriage and death are documents necessary for participation in aspects of civil society. These are part and parcel of everyday life. Credit for establishing Victoria's civil system for the registration of births, marriages and deaths conventionally has gone to William Henry Archer. Some of you may know him, a young actuary appointed to put the system into effect. In fact, it was Victoria's first governor, Charles Joseph Latrobe, and his administration who instigated this pioneering legislation before Archer had even arrived on Australian soil. Tonight, I aim to give you a glimpse of Latrobe's role, often hidden, into fashioning the system that we have come to depend upon today. On Friday, the 29th of October, 1852, a bill for registering births, deaths and marriages, in that order, was transmitted by the Lieutenant Governor, Charles Joseph Latrobe, to the Legislative Council for consideration. 10 weeks later, on the 11th of January 1853, it passed into law. It received Governor Latrobe's assent a week later, on the 18th of January 1853, the 26th piece of legislation to do so in the 1852-53 parliamentary session. Why Latrobe installed this fundamental regulatory tool is unclear. It's possible that he was influenced by the operation of Australia's first civil registration system in place in Van Diemen's Land, where Latrobe was seconded temporarily in late 1846 and early 1847. Van Diemen's Land system, it has to be said, was a simple system of registration, much like that operated by the churches. Victoria's 1853 original scheme was remarkably similar. Latrobe had high expectations of what a registration system would do, expressed during his address at the prorogation of Parliament in early February 1853. He said, "I look upon the Act, the Registration Act, as of no small importance to the colony. It promises to secure the correct compilations of much valuable statistical information, mark the progress of the colony, facilitate proof of births, deaths and marriages, assist in tracing pedigree, and by securing the publicity of deaths occurring under unusual or suspicious circumstances, contribute to the suppression of crime." So from his perspective, registration was going to be a panacea. But according to one important critic, the scheme in place was incapable of delivering these lofty outcomes. By sheer coincidence, in November 1852, just as the registration bill was being considered by the Legislative Council, William Henry Archer arrived in Victoria. Archer, an actuary with a very big beard in every photograph, was intensely interested in matters of life, death, the population and the use of statistics applied to them. Born in London in 1825, Archer began work at age 16 as an apprentice with the Medical Invalid and General Life Assurance Company, under the supervision of a famous statistician, Francis Nyson. Nyson, a giant of statistical science in Britain, mentored Archer for 7 years. Archer then took employment with the Catholic Law and General Life Assurance Company, an engagement that proved unsuccessful. Thus, he made his way to Australia with his parents. On Archer's third day in Melbourne, newspapers reported that the newly created Registrar General's Department was to appoint an officer to undertake its work. The role involved the registration of deeds, births, marriages and deaths, as well as the compilation of statistics pertaining to all aspects of registration. Archer saw his opportunity and arranged to meet with La Trobe and the Auditor-General, Hugh Childers. Obviously, Archer was hopeful. In a letter to his fiancée, Mary, in London, Archer explained the outcome of the meeting. "Unfortunately for me, the brother of the Governor's private secretary has got the place most suited for me. I am told he does not understand his duties, which is a fact not to my advantage again, for I suspect he is afraid to have me even under him, lest I should supplant him." You can say that Archer was nothing but confident. This individual was in all likelihood Frederick Campbell, a draftsman. He applied for a job with the government in 1853. His brother was indeed La Trobe's private secretary, Major Norman Enverdale Savage Campbell, JP. According to historian Margot Beaver, who I might add did a very fine MA on Archer, a perception prevailed that recommendations and connections rather than ability counted for aspirant employees under La Trobe's administration, and Archer had no such connections. As if to publicise his credentials, in early January 1853, Archer wrote a letter to the Herald newspaper, declaring his hope that a Victorian Department of Statistics would employ men of intellect and zeal whose knowledge of how to introduce the system would make Victoria a leader in the British Empire. End of quote. Archer then wrote to Captain William Lonsdale, then Colonial Secretary, actually he might have been Colonial Treasurer by then, in the third week of January 1853. He called him the Colonial Secretary anyway, applying for a position and elucidating his own qualifications in statistics. He wrote again a fortnight later. This time, Lonsdale offered him a position as clerk to work on the Blue Books, which later became the Statistical Registers. His salary was £150. Within a month of being engaged in the department, Archer received instructions from Lonsdale, and I quote, "to draw up a general plan for the guidance of the Chief Registrar and rules in detail for the Deputy Registrars." Registrars were to be the officers responsible for doing the registration work throughout Victoria. Archer, of course, was delighted at this unexpected turn of events. It took less than 2 weeks for him to draw up a substantial proposal for what he called getting the machinery of registration into motion. Initially, he put his general plan to La Trobe through Lonsdale. In it, he deftly pointed out deficiencies in the recently passed statute. In an uncritical fashion, very cleverly, he recommended improvements. The most critical element that we can be thankful for today was Archer's insistence that the colony's registration districts be fixed and clearly defined to tally with the census district, which you can see here on this slide, the original ones. As this, Archer explained, would enable all sorts of useful information and population statistics to be ascertained, the movements of people, the number of both sexes in each district at every age, fluctuations in the shape of births, marriages, deaths and so on. The highly mobile populaces on Victoria's goldfields underscored the need for such a sound framework. Archer wrote a subsequent communication to Lonsdale in late March 1853, suggesting and recommending other vital statistical categories for the department to pursue: meteorology and the weather, lunatics, crime, intemperance, education, and a subject dear to his heart, the mortality of children. Two of Archer's modifications made to the original scheme are of significance to historians of health today, and particularly me. The first concerns birth registrations. I don't know that you'll all be able to see this slide because the print is very fine, and I do apologise. The original birth register, the original schedule for birth registration, which was passed in January 1853, was simple, like the Tasmanian version, and rather like a church baptismal register. It's basically where the child was born and who the parents were. Nothing too fancy. Archer noted, as you'll see on the bottom of the slide, that the certificate of the accoucheur, nurse, or other person present at the birth was not recorded. His recommendation was that this be included. Of course, accoucheur, for those of you who don't know, is the French word for the person assisting at the birth, usually sometimes the midwife, sometimes the doctor. He recommended that changes like that be incorporated. And as you'll see, let me see if this works, this little, oh, it does work. You can see here under witnesses, this one's blank, and we'll probably, someone might talk about that a little bit later. This is the second schedule that came out, and you can see that Archer's included the accoucheur, a nurse, or someone else, perhaps just as witnesses to the birth. Where the idea to include this particular piece of data came from and what Archer's motivation in doing so is unclear. Historians have judged Archer to be morally driven in his approach to population statistics, owing to the influence of his Catholic teacher Nyssen and Archer's own conversion to Catholicism, whereas William Farr in Britain was not extending the registration system to the same extent at the same time. In any case, I'm very thankful for this modification. It's now possible for us to study bedside attendance in maternity cases in the colonial period in Victoria, but not in other colonies. And as many of you know, this has been a central focus of my La Trobe Society Fellowship research. The next modification he recommended, there were numerous ones, concerned death registrations. Archer maintained that a medical attendant should sign a death certificate stating the cause of death, the duration of the sickness, and when the person was last seen by a doctor. Of course, this established the state's relationship with the medical profession very early on in Victoria, but that's a subject for another night. Archer's plan included a uniform method of categorising causes of death. This method you can see in part of his nosological table, which is up here. Doctors in the colony were to use this when writing a certificate of death. I'm only sorry that they didn't, because even though there are some strange categories of death, they would at least have been the same. Whereas people, the medical practitioners certainly didn't comply with that requirement of the Act. This, of course, was not Archer's invention. Earlier ones had been implemented in Britain under Registrar General Dr. William Farr, who was a medical doctor. But I am thankful to Archer for including the nosological data to ascertain trends in conceptualising disease processes and examining death causes. As part of my La Trobe Society Fellowship, I've been examining category number 81, which is deaths from childbirth. And I can tell you they're quite amusing sometimes, simply because people use their own interpretation. Archer set out to build as robust a system as possible. He recruited literate gentlemen as district registrars, squatters, schoolmasters, chemists, shop owners, and businessmen. But he preferred doctors because they were, as he put it, intelligent, efficient, respected, and are a good deal about their patients. Once data was captured, it had to be preserved. In the 1850s, the potential for losing valuable registration data via fire, flood, or simply a lack of care was high. Archer anticipated this problem, instituting processes and directions for the registrars to follow even when it came to writing the entries. Of that, he said, and I quote, "You will make," and every genealogist in the room will just wish they had followed the directions, "you will make every entry under a feeling of responsibility of your office, taking care that every name is properly spelled, that the ink is used is that ordered by the chief registrar, that the writing is very clear and distinct, without flourish of any kind, and as much as possible, a printing style. That each letter is well defined, taking particular care to distinguish between E's and I's, N's and U's, T's and L's, as a very little attention is needed at the time of entry. While carelessness on these points is apt to lead to much correspondence and loss of labour and time, particularly for the chief registrar and the registrars. On registering twins, particular inquiries must be made to distinguish which is the elder. End quote. The implications of poor writing, as we all know, applied similarly to the census taken in April 1854. Some enumerators' penmanship on that occasion was said to be as difficult to decipher as an Egyptian inscription. And that was quite apart from the Chinese element of the census, which called for a translator. Other strategies to minimise the loss of data were that all registration entries were replicated in a second volume, writer's cramp, 4 times a year and on days named by the chief registrar, the deputy and district registrars all over Victoria sent 1 volume of the dual record set into the Melbourne registry. One can only think about what's going on in the rain. If an error was made, it could be corrected within 6 months, but only by making a new entry, because no erasures were permitted. Periodic inspections were put in place. These were to determine how securely a registrar kept his books, whether there was a fireproof receptacle for storing the registers, whether the environment was damp, and whether a registrar's place generally displayed a want of order or arrangement. Archer was certainly optimistic about how his system would work, but it was combined with a dose of pragmatism. Even he recognised that the road to statistical heaven had to start somewhere. La Trobe clearly was impressed with Archer's vision for capturing registration data. He instructed Lonsdale in March 1853 to, and I quote, this is on the bottom there, but it's a bit hard to see, let every arrangement be made as far as possible to carry the system proposed into effect. Emendations or alterations may be made according to circumstances. Originally set to commence on the 1st of April 1853, Archer's modifications meant an inevitable delay to the start of the system on the 1st of July. In the meantime, district registrars were appointed in 35 registration locations within 16 registration districts. As Archer recommended, the districts followed the boundaries of Victoria's Electoral Act, 1851. The next job was for the Registrar General's Department to saturate Victoria with news of compulsory regulation via government gazettes, by publications like the Victoria Commercial and Nautical Almanac for 1855, by handbills and by repeated newspaper articles. The aim was to convince the population that compulsory registration was for their benefit. An extract of these enormous notices, only a tiny bit of which I have here on the slide, reads, "Every inhabitant of the colony may, at some time or other, be interested in knowing the time and date of some birth or death. And a complete system of registration will prevent much litigation in future years and otherwise protect individual rights of property. Besides throwing light on many social questions as to duration of life among children and the upgrown population, to the increase of statistical science and the general advantage of the inhabitants of Victoria." Some people responded to these advertisements, registering promptly. By way of an example, registration number 25 was John Richard Meelan, born at St Kilda in early May to Sarah Meelan and Richard Yule. The infant died 10 weeks later, on the 18th of July. Both were registered and registered with mother's and father's names. The death entry of this particular child is a reminder of why original records are important and useful. A margin note accompanying that death entry reads, discrepancy between name of child and father. For those of you who are familiar with Richard Yule, the father named on the birth and death registrations, he was a prominent surgeon and coroner for the district of Bourke, which covered the city of Melbourne. He'd married someone else 2 years later. So whether he denied that paternity or not, we'll never know. But someone thought to question it. Archer's work progressed reasonably well. His appointment as acting registrar was gazetted on the 25th of April, 1853. A subsequent appointment as acting registrar general was effective from the 1st of July. And in August, Latrobe reportedly told Mr. Archer, "We are all delighted to have hit upon you, Mr. Archer. You have the head that we wanted." However, Archer's time at the top came to an end, and in December 1853, Latrobe appointed his private secretary, Scots-born Major Norman Campbell, JP, to the substantial position of Registrar General. Archer was bitterly disappointed and told his aunt in a letter, and I quote, "I was the originator of the department and formed it wholly, and the general belief was that I should hold the head position. Our former colonial secretary and now colonial treasurer, Captain Lonsdale, told me he considered I might have had it. However, to the great surprise of people generally, Mr. Latrobe, wishing to provide for Major Norman Campbell, his private secretary, gave him the appointment. The outburst of indignation that resounded on all sides on my behalf is said to have been unparalleled in the colony." At the time, Campbell's numerous critics claimed that he had no experience of the work of a chief registrar. Campbell was a member of the Melbourne Board of Management of the Professional Life Assurance Company, a London-based business, similar to that where Archer had learned his profession. So it's possible that Campbell indeed had some understanding of population statistics after all through his life assurance work. Associations, anyway. Any disenchantment at Campbell's elevation was ameliorated when Archer learnt that his own salary remained at £600, exclusive of the 50% allowance for his house rent, which added a further £300. On top of that, Latrobe presented Archer with a gratuity of £200, and colleagues from his department gifted Archer a silver wine cooler weighing over 50 ounces. That's about 1.5 kilos. According to Archer's own records, Latrobe had taken a warm interest in the progress of designing the system. Latrobe read over with Archer several of the proofs, and the spirit evinced by His Excellency communicated itself to most of the government departments. Importantly for Archer, a personal acknowledgement came from Latrobe on the Governor's last day in Victoria, Friday the 5th of May, 1854. At an undress levee at Government House. Archer recounted the story this way. He entered the levee to see Latrobe standing with his officers of state to receive guests. Archer was announced by the Governor's aide-de-camp, and Archer bowed to Latrobe. Latrobe interrupted his conversation, took Archer's hand and pressed it strongly, saying, "I am glad of your success and hope to hear of its continuance." Archer took this gesture to be genuine, noting, "It was a special honour done me. I have since learned that there were very few to whom Latrobe spoke or shook hands with out of those presented on the day." In due course, Archer also recognised the upsides of Campbell's appointment. He told his family, "I have the support of the press, a very powerful engine, and the goodwill of government officers generally. I am relieved of much responsibility and get credit for all that goes well. Major Campbell and myself are first-rate friends. He does not interfere with me, and I travel, and I get my salary of £900 as before." In fact, Archer relished the role of the coalface registration work. For this man of high standards, it enabled him to get the registration machinery into motion correctly from the outset and right at the point of activity. During his inspections of Victoria, Archer wrote detailed reports to Norman Campbell. These are enlightening on the practical challenges of implementing a system like this in the young colony. One example I'm going to give you tonight is Archer's journey to Western Victoria in late October 1854. As he was instructed by Norman Campbell, Archer started out for Geelong on the 21st of October 1854 by steamer, arriving the same evening. He stayed at Mack's Hotel in Geelong for two nights. He visited Registrar Quinnan to discuss a doubtful marriage. Then he saw the Reverend Mr. O'Connell at the New Catholic Mission, 12 miles from Geelong at Mount Duneed. He then rode to Mount Moriac and stayed with Mr. Haynes before travelling out to Duneed, where he examined Mr. Thomas Ray's registers. Thomas Ray was the postmaster, and he ran a well-patronised store. Ray had been a registrar for just 2 months. He was very enthusiastic, travelling out on his horse looking for berths. Archer's only objection to his whole appointment was Ray's bad spelling. Archer wrote, "Constant reference to a dictionary and a gazetteer has already done much for him, and provided he is well looked after, I have considerable hopes that he may yet turn out well. There appears a difficulty in getting anyone more eligible in the neighbourhood in spite of his defects." From Duneed, Archer travelled west towards the Barwon, now called Winchelsea, passing the Lady of the Lake Inn. There were squatters and other families scattered about. The Barwon Inn was full of shearers and hut keepers. Mr. Stirling, the owner of the inn, declined the invitation to be a deputy registrar, but Mr. Mitchell, the local schoolmaster, agreed. As Archer reported, Mitchell was an elderly, respectable-looking man who had been a registrar in England. Happily, his writing was neat. From Duneed the next morning at 7 o'clock, Archer started for the settlement of Colac. This is October. It was a 25-mile journey and took him 5 hours. It was hot, windy, and unpleasant riding. At Colac, he ate and rested and then went off to stay with the Reverend John Bleasdale. Some of you may know Bleasdale's winery, named for this gentleman. He didn't create it, but he was interested in wine. The first port of call in Colac was the registrar and clerk of the court, Mr. James Stedman Farrer. Archer concluded that Farrer's office lacked security. There was no fireproof receptacle for the registers, not even a tin deed box. It also transpired that Farrer could not, or would not, make visits beyond a radius of 6 miles of town, from town. The Reverend Bleasdale was reportedly a good bushman, so with Bleasdale as his guide that afternoon, Archer decided to visit these places by himself, riding 10 miles north of Colac by Lake Corangamite. There they met two or three settlers. At Corunnan Estate, Archer met David Stoddart, a squatter and non-practising doctor. Stoddart too declined to be a registrar, but agreed that any births and deaths would be registered at Colac. Archer and Bleasdale rode back to Colac just before midnight. They arrived so late because Archer's horse had broken its bridle and bolted on the road. It had to be caught, and the halter mended the next day, giving Archer a well-earned day off to rest and report to Norman Campbell by letter. It was 8 days since he'd left Melbourne. The next morning, I do apologise for the quality of this slide, but that's as good as we'll get. The next morning, Archer and Bleasdale rode southeast to the county of Polwarth, where there was no registrar. The pair was aiming for Dean's Marsh, about 20 miles from Colac. I have actually marked this journey on here, probably too small for you to see, but they're around this area. Dean's Marsh was 20 miles from Colac as the crow flies and situated, as he described it, at the foot of the high barren ranges. the pair came across several huts and discovered to their surprise that the parents there knew about registration. They reached the Barwon River but could find nowhere to cross safely. A shepherd piloted them to a spot where there was a fallen tree lying across the river. Archer climbed along the log and made it to the other side. Bleasdale whipped the horses over to Archer, who caught them. Reverend Bleasdale then followed across via the log. I wondered what he was wearing. Probably. Using Ham's settler's map of 1854, the pair made for a mission station. Good luck with that, is all I can say, where some stockmen fed them a passable damper and a pannikin of what Archer called an odious tea. Following the stockman's directions, the pair then became hopelessly lost. Whether that was the map, themselves, or the stockman's directions, we'll never know. But they rode around for hours, late into the night, in persistent rain, through muddy marshes and heavily treed country, without a moon to guide them. Eventually, in the middle of the night, they stumbled across a broad cattle track which led to a shelter. The next morning, in broad daylight, they discovered that they'd been within 3 miles of their destination for most of the previous afternoon and evening. Such was the thicket of Victoria's bush. Fortunately for Archer, George Vickery, Esquire of Dean's Marsh, agreed to be registrar, so the ride was worth it. His role was to ensure registration of births south of the Barwon River, down to Apollo Bay, across to Cape Otway, not a tiny amount of land, we might add. Armed with this success, Archer and Bleasdale turned home for Colac. But this time at the Barwon River crossing, the horses balked at the steep bank and bolted without their riders. Archer and Bleasdale had to again catch their transport and so arrived in Colac late at night. This was the taxpayers' £900 at work. Following this eventful trip, Archer's torn and muddy trousers needed repair and cleaning. While waiting for the repairs, the ever energetic Archer revisited Registrar Farrer. Dr. Stoddart, he discovered, had already registered a birth. In his progress report of this inspection to Registrar General Campbell, Archer reflected that it is evidently a beneficial thing for both the registrars and the settlers to have someone now and then from headquarters to visit them. It makes all the parties feel a livelier interest in the registration system. The next day was Archer's 13th of his southwest visitation. The heat was excessive and Archer was unwell. He blamed sleeping in a hut, the unpalatable tea, the agricultural damper, and morsels of salt junk. Salt junk was cured meat, notoriously tough and very unappetizing. Archer took the day to recuperate at Reverend Bleasdale's, and on day 14, he continued to Tim Boone. Archer completed several of these inspection tours, perhaps explaining why the system was so successful so early. Having direct contact with registrars all over Victoria certainly helped to iron out these early problems in the scheme, one of which was the original location of registration centres. The Act, which had passed the Parliament, of course, had provided for clerks of the Petty Session Courts, like the man in Colac, to be district registrars, but this turned out to be a disincentive because they were based at police stations. In his 1854 report to Parliament, Archer raised this issue, writing, "A promiscuously crowded police office is not a desirable place in which females with young children should be compelled to attend, perhaps for hours, to register births." Archer recommended instead that doctors be engaged as registrars so that they could use their homes as register offices. Henry Mundy's memoirs held at the State Library of Victoria show that using doctors as registration officers was an inspired decision. In 1855, Anne Mundy's first baby was sacrificed to save the mother's life. The next year, Anne and Henry had a son. Not long after he was born, Anne Mundy said to her husband, "We will have to get the baby registered. The doctor told me so. So we will have to choose names for him." "Names," Henry said, "how many?" "You and I," Anne said, "were baptised with only one Christian name, but that is old-fashioned. Every child now has two names or more." A couple of days later, Henry walked from Brown's Diggings near Bendigo to Maryborough to register George Francis. On his return, Anne's salute was, "Well, did you register the baby?" Naturally, this system had imperfections. In Bendigo, one newspaper complained that a man might as well almost search for a nugget of 100 pounds weight as for a copy of the Registration Act. This rebuff was in response to a reported breach of the Act in which a burial had proceeded without the requisite death certificate from a doctor. Ignorance of the Act was no defence. Registration did not cost anything, but it was compulsory. And curious in retrospect for the genealogists in the room, one provision of the Registration Act may be of interest to you. Babies born after the 1st of July 1853, in theory, had to be registered within 60 days of that birth. Of course, we know that this did not happen. People have sent me examples, actually, which I haven't used in this talk, when they're years apart, as they were all around Australia. But under Section 12 of the Act, if 12 months passed without a birth being registered and if the birth had not occurred at sea, it was illegal for a chief registrar or a deputy registrar to register the birth. No citizenship for you. And no certified copies could be issued to vouch for it. Ultimately, Archer's system was designed to encourage compliance. In conclusion, Archer's report of the registration system in September 1854 judged the scheme to be a triumph. He declared that England has nothing so complete. Victoria has therefore the honour of being the first to work out so uniform and elaborate a system. And hence, the mother country may learn something in the practice of the youngest of its colonies. William Archer's great achievement was his modification of the registration system and his inspired implementation of it. Within a relatively short time and without too many objections, a useful and expansive civil registration system which accounted for life's milestones was part and parcel of everyday existence for Victorians. But the scheme was not Archer's alone, and I think we should remember that. La Trobe and his administration's achievement was the foresight to introduce this regulatory tool in the first place, before William Archer arrived to refashion it and implement it. For this significant contribution to Victorian life today, La Trobe and his administration deserve some credit. Thank you.
Really fascinating, because I'm sure all of you have probably done your family history and have had these conundrums and mysteries and spelling mistakes. Before I ask questions for everybody else, I have one of my own, which is the penalties for not registering it. Were they severe? Did they try and use the stick, or was it the encouragement that sort of got that going? So what happened if you didn't register?
They built in substantial penalties of £5 for lack of registration, but in fact it wasn't births that were lack of registration of births that was penalised first. It was death without a burial without a death certificate, because of course that had a health implications. Mm-hmm. There was a Cemeteries Act. I think there was a Cemeteries Act in progress. I'm prepared to be corrected on that. But the death really that the what I didn't talk about today was the motivation of the government in curbing crime. And of course inquests are called when somebody's done something dodgy, whether it's a birth or, something at a birth, or whether it's murder. And really, I think that's behind the motivation for certificates of death issued by a doctor necessarily for burial. So there were penalties for the funeral directors as well as the individuals. Like if a funeral director buried without a death certificate, they were in trouble too. And there's some lovely examples, as you can imagine, because it's in Victoria, it's all about the weather.
Yes.
of bodies becoming increasingly gaseous. Yes.
And so there are court cases. People get put before the magistrates. It's not just there in theory.
There are two cases, particularly for those of you around the Bendigo goldfields, because people buried someone without a death certificate. And if you buried a baby, you were in just as much trouble. Mm. But, of course, if you were on your own up in near Horsham, no one was going to know that you buried a baby. So it depended where you were as to how much you said about what I did. There was a lot of telling tales in this system, as it turns out, particularly with women and babies.
Yes, and creative registrations that details change. And I'm sure we've all got our stories. Look, there's bound to be some questions here, but really fascinating talk. Yes.
Carry on.
Did he have to sign?
No. Did Yule have to sign? No. Did he want to be the dad? Probably not. I mean, this is an interesting issue because for those of you who don't know Richard Yule, he's a very important and influential coroner in town, and he hates midwives, just by the by. But the thing about registration that it had to prove who you were. So theoretically, whoever was giving the information now knows who you are and when you were born and how long you've lived in the colonies and presumably knows the father. Because registration was not just about, you know, the civic good of citizenship. It was about inheritance and property rights. So if someone could prove that Richard Yule was their father and he had a lot of money, there might be an interest in 1853 to go and pursue him in the courts. So to answer your question, no, the father certainly didn't have to write it. Often a brother wrote it. Or people had no idea at a death entry how long someone had lived in the colony. Therefore, you have, if you've got someone, three siblings writing, issuing a instructions to a registrar about their father, they'll all have a different job, which is may well be true, but they've usually been in the colony anywhere from 10 to 50 years. So early things, I think, you really have to take with a grain of salt.
Do you take a marriage certificate as being more authoritative than a death certificate, in that you can't tell people how old you are when you've died? But
no.
So there's often a mismatch between that.
Yes.
And the other one, which is very pertinent to a case that I'm working on at the moment, is a discussion about whether a person who's registered and baptised under a particular name doesn't use that name for the rest of his life. Is that person, how do we prove that person, the one who uses the other name?
When I
so
said...
didn't have deed poll, change of names.
No,
like that,
did no change of name by deed poll. So the person who forgot to register their child within the 12 months after the birth, they kept moving it from 6 months to 12 months and back to 60 days. They modified these things. But there was a roundabout way of using a baptismal record. But, you know, if Reverend Hogg up there at Pentridge didn't keep great records, that wasn't going to be much help either. And his writing was probably bad and it had rained through the shingles and that register was wet. You know, there's a series of unintended errors that might mean that genealogy naturally has a lot of brick walls. Mm. So don't ever get frustrated by them. Use the newspaper. They'll be in there somewhere.
Any other questions? We always believe the newspaper. I always believe the newspapers. Question there.
But I believe the crime list. So, crime list is very useful. Yes, Lenore.
The gentleman next to the Lenore, I'll take first.
Oh, Lenore. Douglas. It's Douglas.
What extent did they try to recover the records of the 1840s?
Actually, they... Archer made a huge effort to... Some of you may know his first report on vital statistics, and he contacted people like Faulkner. He wrote to all kinds of people, and there's some lovely explanations of who's buried in the Melbourne Cemetery underneath the market car park, and which Aborigines did what, and who was the firstborn child, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, he made a huge effort to account for all of that material. Of course, it's imperfect, but it's necessarily... It says a lot about the man that he was interested in this stuff. There was a beginning to white settlement in his eyes, and from then on in, it was important to record everything that possibly could be recorded. He was fanatical about the weather.
Fanatical.
That's not a planted question, even though it's right up my alley. Thank you, Lenore, because I cannot tell you how many of these there are. There's a blank. And I know that when people have said their mother, because I'm looking at women, a female attendants, women have been mentioned in... If you go to Penshurst, for example, they're really very thorough. Richmond's pretty good, but I agree. Flemington is a case unto itself. Because doctors had a particular interest in imposing their view of care on the world, and that's part of... I can say that because it's my research. One thing I left out was that one of the first complaints came about this system in 1857, substantial complaint, like lots of letters, was because there was no capacity to register stillbirths, mm-hmm. and no capacity to differentiate between illegitimate and legitimate births. How a child is ever illegitimate, I'll never know. But, of course, that's in keeping with the time. But the doctors were very, very critical of the system as it existed.
Shame he wasn't a better doctor. Kristen, right back, Richard Broom, I think.
Yes?
Were they
honorary? Did they get paid?
Oh, no. The question was, did the registrars get paid? They did. But... I can't remember.
Payment by results or by...
Yeah, by entry. By entry. So you didn't get a payment if you made a mistake and had to put another entry in.
Yeah.
They did get paid. I think it was sixpence an entry, but I can let you know, Richard, the date, what's it at home. But when they crossed that river and lost their horses at on the way to Dean's Marsh... Archer noted in his letter to Norman Campbell, no wonder the Colac registrar doesn't want to come this way. So you can imagine, you know, it's hard work. And if you had to pay for your trousers to be repaired and a bridle had to be repaired, that came out of your budget. All of the mail that went to the registrar general's department was free, but you had to buy the tin deed box and you had to pay, you know, you could be supplied with ink, but if you ran out or tipped it over, you would have to get more ink, even if it didn't comply. So I think it was probably not a very lucrative job to do.
Yep, so a couple more questions.
Yes, yep.
Now, Madonna, you began your talk by telling us that birth certificates are really quite important today, and they have certainly been for me. I'm often asked to produce one, for example, working with children check
yep.
or... who weren't required to provide a certificate. So you've gone through the process of getting a certificate, but how often were you asked to produce it?
That's a good point. You probably had to produce it for the marriage certificate. That's a good point. I hadn't even thought about that. You probably had to produce it for the marriage certificate. But, see, Victoria is so different from Van Diemen's Land in Sydney, which were colony-based. So a lot of the interest in having identity is about the ticket of leave and, you know, what ship you came on. So originally, lots of material that's recorded about people in Victoria, it says free. So there's nothing else because you're free. Like, the rest of you is not important. You're only important if you're a felon. So... And you really didn't need a pass port unless you were going to pass a port. So possibly for leaving a port, I'd have to have a transport. Is there a transport historian in the room? That's a very good question. I'll follow that up, Janice.
Perhaps last question.
There's one here.
Two last questions. Marjorie, did you have a question?
Of course. And before trains, there were horses and feet. And there was rain and leather bags. So some of the material I did, you know, some of this Archer paper stuff that he's kept is so mouldy. I don't know where he kept it, or his family kept it. Yeah. A supplementary question. It's highly amusing if you know anything about death now. But yes, they're very important to notice because they can explain a lot about inquests too. And a lot of the registrars in these district areas became coroners.
And I think it's, as we're discussing the fact that so much of this material is now much more readily available to the average amateur researcher, that it's... historians still have a great role as interpreters, even if it's deciphering the handwriting as well as the business of what it means. So we're not out of a job yet. Look, I'll take one very last question at the back.
Dropsy. I can speak to you later. There, if you're interested in some of this, I'm writing a book as part of my La Trobe Society Fellowship, so I will be addressing some of this because it's complex. And a lot of the maternal deaths certainly aren't recorded as related to being pregnancy, even though someone who's experienced knows that they are. Janet McCalman's History of the Women's. Janet used a group of retired medical doctors, not all retired, I beg your pardon, to look at the case books at the women's and judge as far as possible a modern assessment of the circumstances of those women who were admitted and maybe died. Not all of them died. So that would be worth reading because Janet really went through that in a very substantial way.
It's been a really fascinating session and one of the liveliest we've had, but I can see there'd be plenty more questions if we kept on going, but we do have to wind up. I'm glad that twice you've mentioned in your talk that you were a CJ La Trobe Society fellow holder of that fellowship. It's really worth emphasising that because the La Trobe Society has, of which I think most of us in the room are members, has done a wonderful job in a number of areas, keeping the reputation of La Trobe alive, but really bringing alive that period as a time of research. But for me as a historian, the opportunity, I'm delighted that these opportunities are there to allow scholars to spend a little bit of time in the State Library of Victoria to work on this sort of material and enhance our knowledge, and it's really through the work of the La Trobe Society that this has been possible. So you're not only a great asset to the society, but a great testimonial to that project. And so I think we can all take a pat on the back. But in particular, the person who we know is really the great inspiration of the La Trobe Society, I'm going to ask Dr. Diane Riley to step forward and please both give a vote of thanks to our
Thank you.